I feel good about a moral life. This is Dr. Herbert L. Byerly, Dean of the University of Healing here in Campo, California, bringing you instant inspiration. I feel good about a moral life. I'm really a very hard person to get along with. I was brought up in the generation where you waited to have sex until you got married. And at least that's what my mother told us, you know. And so that's what we were expected to do. And if anyone had a baby before they got married, it was considered not very chic, you know. And so as I later counseled with children, they were 21 and over, you know, who were getting married because they had a child or something, I had to sort of redefine my focus. I think the word moral has to be looked at in its realistic frame. Now, in the dictionary, they define moral as right and wrong. Okay? You got it? Okay. Usually concerning manners and society. Usually relationships between individuals. Now, in our philosophy, we teach be yourself and have fun. We teach live your life in a most noble way that is always from your highest and your best. We say do everything that turns you on, that makes you happy, and so forth. Now, to do that, you sometimes step on the toes of morals, of things that you have learned is right and wrong. There's a recent article in the Discovery magazine about heredity. And in there, they said that only in the Christian communities, basically, are they concerned about marriage within the family, marriage to cousins, or even marriage to children and marriage to what, you know. That other religions, other philosophies, other ways, other cultures have no problem there. They don't see any problem. And research was done by this scientific group, and they found that there really was no problem. And they found that, as in breeding dogs, you breed for their highest and best qualities, and you breed a dog that's got a good quality. And the smart thing to do is, while you're doing that, to breed in some other qualities too. Qualities of wholeness, qualities of strength, qualities of perfect conformation. You might say, breed in, boy, oh boy, you know, sounds interesting. Well, this is really what it's all about. Now that Queen Victoria had this blood disease and transmitted it throughout the European kingdoms during her time, because all of her children were married off to everybody in the kingdom, you know, the Russians, the Germans, the French, the Italians, the whomevers, you know. And she, of course, was a British ruler. And hemophilia became quite a problem in the royal families. And many of the children became hemophiliacs, and they were unable to conduct their lives in a normal manner. Rasputin, you may have heard of him, Rasputin. He was supposed to come in and mentally cure the child of the Russian czar, but he was more of a hypnotist than anything else, and he wasn't too successful. But it just helps to make the story more dramatic. But the scientists today, in doing research into this, they do research into mice, into other creatures, and into man, because they know where these things have happened and where these things are happening, and they research it, and they get money from the federal government to research it. They're fascinating. So they have found that all of the taboos, and I shouldn't say all of the taboos, they found that many of the taboos that have been brought against society that have been brought against humanity were just religious and social taboos and had nothing to do with the other. That's, for instance, the Hebrews. There was a time when swine had trichinosis, is it, or something like that, and they transmitted that into humans who ate them. And so they, the priests didn't know anything about that. They just knew that that was where it came from. They just knew it in their heart. You know, there's something told them that. And so the divine in them told them that's what it is. They didn't have their scientific instruments out there. They didn't know how to research this, but they knew. And so instead of just saying, for a time, we will not eat pork, they said this is one of the tenets of the Hebrew teaching, no pork. Period. End of comment. And it turned out that that was not something that was universally consistent in swine. It was in certain groups. Well, it's like hoof and mouth disease over in England today, or in Canada today. They're experiencing hoof and mouth disease right at this moment. And people don't want to buy meat products from Canada because of the hoof and mouth disease. It's consistent up there. Some other disease, I may have the wrong word for it, but the scientists are saying under certain conditions it does not exist. When that meat has been treated or processed or something like that, the disease does not come through. If the meat is raw, if it is not prepared right, then of course the disease has come through. Now, who's going to guarantee that the meat is always prepared right? I went out this morning and I went into the garage and I saw one of our beautiful cats on top of the truck, and he was just sitting up there purring away like he had the canary, and I thought something will turn up. And then as I was ready to leave the garage, he had gotten down under the front of the car, and there he had a great big fat mouse that he had dispatched, and he was now in the process of preparing it for his dinner, or breakfast rather. So, you know, what did they eat? I was deer hunting with my father back in the 40s, and I went there as the cook. That was why I could be along with him. And so I cooked lots of good meals. Mother gave me a bunch of recipes, and I quickly learned them. And then the guys brought in rabbits. They couldn't find any deer, so they shot the rabbits. And they brought the rabbits back, and they were saying, hey, look at the rabbits. Look at the, they had about 10, 12 rabbits. And I said, hey, I'll make some Hassan pepper. And so I took the rabbits and cleaned them, stripped them down, cleaned them out, and mixed them all together with a great big kettle after cooking the rabbits and thoroughly. And then putting in vegetables. Oh, it was a big old wonderful pot of stuff. And I cooked it and made it all. And when my dad came home from hunting, he says, what is this? And I told him. He says, oh, no, no, no. Those rabbits have a disease at this time of year. And that is something that can be transferred to humans. And so out. And so he took my entire beautiful pot of stew, the first one that I ever made by myself, completely with meat and everything in it. It's big, because there were about 8 of us guys, 10 of us guys up there. And dumped it. And I thought, no, I didn't take a picture of it, but I should have. My first really great delight, you know. But perhaps he was overdoing it. Perhaps the cooking would have taken away any of the problem. And perhaps not. He didn't want to take a chance. He didn't know how thoroughly I had done everything. And knowing me, he wasn't sure. Because I did things as I wanted to do it. And most youngsters do that. I think I was 14 at the time. But it was great. But the only way I could go along is if I was a cook. Mm-hmm. So I did. But you see, we have these rules and traditions and things that come down to us over the ages. You've seen science fiction stories of Atlantis and other things where people were afraid to go. Well, you know the story of Plato himself, remember? The story of Plato, the man in the cave, the whole people were were captive in a cave, mm-hmm. and for years and years and years. And every time they look out the cave, they'd see these giant people walking by when the sun was shining on them, reflecting them up on the rocks, naturally making them look quite large. And they were afraid to get out. So one guy, he went out of the cave. He was one of these, you know, rebels. And he says, "I'm going." So he went out of the cave, and he went up there, and he saw the shadow of the people cast against the wall. So he came back, and he told the people, "Hey, that's only a shadow. That's only a shadow." And they tied him up and put him in the back of the cave. I don't remember whether they killed him or not, but they tied him. They didn't want him to infect the group with the idea that they could go out there and then be hurt, because that was evil out there. Those were evil giants walking back and forth across the front of their cave, and they weren't really there at all. But you see, we build up these morals, we build up these rules, we build up the ethics of our society based upon what we believe to be true or what we know to be true, and in the end result, we find out that it's just a shadow. It's just trichinosis in a pig for a short period of time, as the pig gets it out of its system or whatever it is, and dies usually, you know. And we make fetishes out of them. We make rules. We make morals out of them forever and ever and ever. One moral being, don't marry your cousin, you know. Marry outside. Well, that's just to bring new blood into the community and strengthen up the gene banks and things like that. Well, that's okay, but you see, when you think of it, don't do it, you know. Mm-hmm. And many societies in the early days, they had a father and a mother and kids, and then the kids intermarried with the kids and or with the neighbor kids. There weren't really any neighbors, but they became neighbors then, you know. And then maybe about 10 miles away was another family. But in between were the large animals that kept them from wandering off because they didn't come home. The animals had them for dinner. So they didn't go out traveling very much alone, and they didn't see who was on the other side of the mountain. And so they had no rule against marriage within the family. That's just the way life went. And then later, when somebody in the group says, look, we want to bring in better blood, so we now have a new rule. No marriage, no relationships inside the family. And so that became a rule, and then it became a law, and then it became the law of the land. Mm-hmm. And just like right now, the federal government, the Supreme Court, they had facing them whether sodomy was illegal. And the Supreme Court said, we cannot say it is, because it is the ruling of a Christian religion, and it's not all religions. And they have to represent all religions. And they cannot have one rule that is governed by based on one religion and not on another. And so they struck that from the rules, and they made every state that had it on strike it from the rules. Now, whether that's good or whether that's bad, that's not our decision. It's not our problem. It's not our choice, perhaps. But the thing is, it becomes a law. It becomes the rule of the land. And we do this. We do this. Now, just to play a little game here before we finish here, think of this. In the days of Atlantis, you heard the story before, in the days of Atlantis, the people had gained great skill, and they could think their thought and speak their word and bring forth whatever they wished. Neat. Anything they wished. They could build their pyramids, they could do anything they wanted to do. Have their homes. If they wanted a home that you could see through, you could see through. If they walked through, you could walk through. If not, you didn't. And it could be invisible, it can be visible. They could do anything. Well, then some Sharpies came along, and they said, hey, you shouldn't have to do that. Let me do the thinking for you. And so pretty soon, the people agreed to give up their job of thinking and thinking things into being, and they gave it to these scientists. And the scientists soon realized the power they had. And with that power, they thought, well, now let's see if we can make people uncomfortable or make people comfortable or do all sorts of things. And they created the power to serve a contrary purpose for the people. And so, kaboom, the whole thing went shazam, you know. And this is what happens to us. This is what happens to us. Just like I was speaking this morning about Hitler, if he had been guided as he was writing his book and edited out of his book those things that were not beneficial, he could have been a great man, a great ruler, a great humanitarian. And there are many great humanitarians today who have been trained in the art of humanitarianism by their parents, by their friends. I'm sure Bill Gates has been trained in the art of humanitarianism. It didn't come natural for him to give away billions of dollars, you know, even though he had them, because he wasn't brought up that way. His father was a lawyer and worked for a living. Mother worked for a living. They all just scrimped along, and he just happened to strike pay dirt. And his father, who was a lawyer, I'm sure guided him in thinking about humanitarian work. And when his mother died of cancer of some sort, I think that he took that on as a great chore to find the cure as best he could, if money could do it. And he certainly has the money to do it. So, I feel good about a moral life because my moral life is based upon being myself and having fun. My moral life is based upon doing those things that make me happy. It doesn't make me happy to hurt another person. It doesn't make me happy to take from another person. It doesn't make me happy to be a manipulator of another person. It only makes me happy to be myself. And if I need money, if I choose money, then I just create it in my world. If I desire relationships, I just create them in my world. I have been married to Ellen so many times by people who greet us, and they say, "And how's your wife, Ellen?" You know, "Well, she's just fine." You know, and you get to the point of not bothering with it. But in those people's minds, we were legally married, and we were legally doing everything right. The fact that we had separate bedrooms and that we had separate rooms in hotels and stuff like that didn't make any difference. You know, they just thought, you know, that's the way they are, these crazy Americans. But so be it. So be it. I feel good about a moral life because I have designed the morals and I live by them. And I'm a very, very happy guy. I love you. I love you. I love you.